This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, a website, a portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today by visiting squarespace.com and use offer code TREK10 to save 10%. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry. And you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated Star Trek books and comics show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me again this week, I don't know why he's here, he's just always hanging around with me for some reason over here. It's Matthew Rushing. Matthew, what are you doing on the show again this week?
Well, Chris, I feel like I'm this show's morn. I'm just kind of like that guy who's always at the 602 club, just always there, you know, never leaves.
Always there, yeah.
Especially if it was the 602 club, it's because I've been sitting there trying to figure out what the names of Ruby's children are going to be because, well, one, I like redheads, and two, who wouldn't want to marry Ruby? My goal would be to beat Trip Tucker at figuring out the names. That's why I'm hanging around. And four,
you're hoping to see Phlox's face puff up.
That too. So, I mean, goodness, we've just mentioned all the things that have happened on the network this week. So you probably won't have to put that promo spot. Yeah, we won't need that promo need spot. That's what I'm doing here, Chris. What are you doing here? I mean, you're always here every week.
I'm just always sitting at this desk. I'm always in this chair pretty much 7 days a week. And so, you know, I'm already here, so I might as well just hit record and say something.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you did because, you know, Chris, I was gone for that week, but you had Larry on to talk about Stellar Cartography, his brand new book, and talked a great conversation. I loved listening to you guys. But, you know, was over at the Truck Collective, and they have all of these brand new promo images for Larry's new book coming out. And goodness, are they fantastic. And that's our news story this week. The only one we've got, but a big one.
That's right. Yeah. The conversation with Larry was fascinating, and he was describing what these maps were going to be like and explaining that this is not really a book per se. You know, it opens up and you've got all these maps inside. I mean, there is a little book component to it, but when I saw this, and I saw this earlier in the week, I think it was when I was setting up the Ready Room news, actually, for the most recent Ready Room, except I didn't put it in there because I wanted to talk about it here on our book show. This stuff's beautiful. I'm so excited now to see what we're actually going to get here. And you know, Larry talked about the material that these maps are printed on and how it doesn't crease easily. And so you'll be able to unfold these and put them up on your wall if you want to. And after seeing them in these images, I think there's going to be a lot of Star Trek fans out there with their walls plastered in these maps come December.
Well, and Chris, we were talking a little bit before the show, and for me, this is the kind of thing that I've really wanted. You know, I'm an adult now, you know, and the kind of things that I want from, say, nonfiction Trek books, this is really what I'm hoping for. So we got the great Federation First 150 Years, which I feel like is just an amazing book, really well done, the kind of thing I'm hoping to see. This is the kind of thing, as well as a fan, that I'm really hoping to see. Great collectible stuff. You know, I mean, this is, you know, being able to put these up on my wall, being able to pull them out whenever I want to be able to look at something that's being referenced in a book. This is fantastic. And, you know, as great as online is, sometimes I would love to be able to just have a big map that I can pull out that I'm not having to kind of scroll around because I don't have a ginormous screen that everything's on. This is great, and this is great work, and it comes from Larry.
Yeah, this is what you need, Matthew, because when you're planning your invasion, you need a big map. You know, it's hard to figure out where you're going to place your ships, you know, how you're going to attack the enemy if you have to keep sliding stuff around on the screen. You
exactly.
can't see the entire area.
Well, you know, in that cut scene from Star Trek VI that they put into the extended version where Colonel West is using the flip map, you know, that he has. Right. And everybody's like, why is he using a flip map? I mean, they've got computer screens right. and everything like that. And I'm thinking, well, it's the same reason that I would pull out Larry's stellar cartography and these maps, because sometimes you just want to have a map. You know, you want to be able to lay it out. And then, of course, there's the great scene as well in Star Trek VI where the Klingons roll out their big maps, you know, in front of Azad right. Bor. And so, you know, apparently...
Yeah.
Oh, well, and then our favorite scene, I don't know if that's turned into a Star Trek VI rant, but then our favorite scene is when they pull out the dictionaries because Uhura yes. doesn't speak Klingon, which...
Right.
Very funny scene, but... I think probably a worse scene than when Scotty runs into the bar in Star Trek Star Trek V and knocks himself out. I honestly think that that's probably a more damaging scene for a character than that. So, yeah, anyway.
I think so. Yeah, yeah, I agree. But you know, it's kind of like Battlestar Galactica, where the new one, where Adama doesn't want to have the networked computers.
Oh, yes.
That technology
yes.
in the ship. And so here it is. You know, sometimes you just need to have paper maps rolled up.
Yeah, you really do. And it's smart. If you're not going to slave your computers together, then you're going to need some some paper mats. And these, I just love. I'm really excited that this is coming out. I'm really hoping that people will buy these. This is a great deal. It's $47.99. It's not that expensive on Amazon. That is off the list price, which is $79.99. So this is a fantastic deal coming out in December. Fantastic thing to be getting your you know, Star Trek friends for Christmas right out at the right time. You know what I'm going to be wanting under the tree. This is a great look, and it comes in that awesome clamshell. It's got all of the maps in it. It's got this great book in it as well. It's beautiful.
You know, we were talking about how we love getting these kinds of things, but we're concerned that if not enough people buy them, they're not going to make any more. And I think that's a very real concern, because it's a lot of work and it's a lot of expense to produce something like this. You know, it's not just like printing a book. There's so much custom stuff going on here. I am glad, however, that these books are being put out, and this was the same with the Federation, the first 150 years, by 47 North, which is an imprint of Amazon. And I like the fact that Amazon is involved, because I feel that Amazon is a company, when it comes to books, that will be willing to produce specialty items and put out some of that money for the overall sake of books and publishing. Now, I mean, I don't love everything Amazon does. You know, I'm concerned about how the impact of online retail like this affects small bookshops, for example. However, I do think that this is a case. You see Audible's doing it, which Audible is also owned by Amazon, and they're doing it with a lot of great science fiction classics, where they're bringing in people to read great science fiction and create very high quality audiobooks that none of the other publishers will do anymore. So I see that carrying through a little bit here in some of the stuff that we're getting with Star Trek, and I really appreciate that.
Well, man, if they could do it for Star Trek Audible books as well, I mean, we have plenty of readers who would love to have those. So, goodness, I do appreciate this. And in fact, I do have give a huge shout out to them, because they sent me Federation first 150 years to be able to look out, to be able to review, keep that copy. I love having it. It's fantastic. Looks great on the shelf. This will be another thing that I'll hope to be able to get and to get a chance to review, especially with Larry, who's friend of the network. We want to be promoting this for him, because this is a big deal. And really glad that they, like you said, they're doing this. So it's a big thank you to them for doing this. It's beautiful. It looks good. We'll definitely be pushing this on the show. I think this is something that everybody's going to want. You know, we had talked, I think, when we did the show about our favorite nonfiction books.
Reference books.
Exactly, yeah, reference books. Yeah. Philip even talked about having and really liking the schematics for the Enterprise D. This mm-hmm. is one of those things just as beautiful, just as well done. I really think that this is something fans should go get. So I was glad that this was going to be our only news item this week because it definitely is worth showcasing.
Most definitely, yeah. So we'll put a link in the show notes again. Hop over to Amazon, pre-order. As Larry has said, pre-orders are kind of like the likes of publishing these days. If you pre-order from Amazon, that helps them, you know, gauge interests as well and may help us get more of these titles in the future. So I was really looking forward to that. Now that, as you said, Matthew, is the only item we have in news today. The meat of today's show is our interview with David R. George III about Revelations and Dust, kicking off the fall series. But before we get into that, Matthew, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for today's show. And of course, that sponsor is Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that combines hosting and content management, and it makes it simple for you to create your own space online. You know, you could create a blog if you just want to talk about a particular topic. You can create a website if you have bigger plans or you're a business. If you're an artist, you can do a portfolio, a musician, you know, you can share your music online. They have great audio tools built into the platform as well. Or if you want to sell things, you can create an online store. Or, you know, Matthew, what could also be cool, I'd love to see someone do this with Squarespace, is to use some of the really fantastic templates that they have, the very visual ones, to create a site dedicated to stellar cartography in Star Trek. Maybe even Larry should get on this. And you can have like an online supplemental to what we're getting here in the books that we just talked about. I think that would be brilliant online, and Squarespace would be the perfect platform for that. But, you know, whatever you want to create on Squarespace, there are really three key areas that really attract me to the platform all the time. And why don't you tell us about those?
Well, Chris, as you were talking about, you have the design-focused nature of Squarespace and the fact that they really do care about design. Their templates are all extremely clean and neat so that they allow your content really to be the focus of the website. And for me, one of the most important things, I think is a great reference, as you see on Trek FM, you can see that cleanliness and it just that focused nature that allows our content to just pop. The next thing that I really do love about it is just that you can connect all of those accounts that you might want to share all of this information on your site easily. So you've got your Twitter, your Facebook, your LinkedIn, your Pinterest, your Instagram, your Google, and we could go on and on because the list is endless these days of social media outlets where you want to share your content. And this Squarespace makes that simple and easy to do. You can set up the times you want it to be done. You can put everything in there to make it simple and easy. And then lastly, it's got responsive design. And as we know, Chris, from living in a world where we all do things on the mobile, you've got your phone, you've got your tablet and your computer, Squarespace has unique design so that the mobile design scales automatically to wherever you're looking at your site, which is fantastic because it really makes your site and your content pop out best by whatever medium you're looking it on. So whether it's my iPhone or my computer, the site looks fantastic.
Yeah, it just reflows to fit the screen size and orientation with you just building the site one time in the browser, which is a fantastic time saver and makes it easier on your visitors as well. And, you know, also I mentioned in the beginning that if you want to sell items, you can create a store. Squarespace has teamed up with Stripe to create a fantastic commerce feature that allows you to sell physical or digital goods on your website and process credit cards, calculate taxes, you know, handle setting up your shipping information and all this stuff. And it's very, very easy to get going. It only takes a few minutes. And in terms of pricing, it's $24 per month for the commerce plan. And then for transactions, you just pay a small fee to Stripe for credit card purchases, the same way you would in any system where you accept credit cards. And that's it. And it's all integrated. You don't need to go out and get an outside system and put that into your website. It's an all-in-one package with Squarespace. It makes it a very, very simple, the simplest way I've seen to sell products online. So if you are looking to set up a store, you definitely need to check out Squarespace. But whether it's a store or a blog or a website or portfolio, The best way for you to find out how great these tools are is to just try it for yourself. And you can do that free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. Just enter your name and your email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be building your website. If you already use a platform like WordPress, you can take that data, you can import it into Squarespace, see how your site looks there, and find out how the Squarespace tools give you everything you need to create an exceptional website. And then when you decide to sign up, and I know you're going to want to, as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts by using our offer code TREK10. And as I mentioned earlier, if you choose the annual plan, you can get a free custom domain registration as well. So you can get yourname.com, yourcompany.com. Hook that right up. It's very, very simple to hook up, and you'll be good to go. So support us and support Squarespace by going to squarespace.com, try it free for 14 days, then use offer code TREK10 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of The Ready Room and Trek FM.
We're really excited tonight to have with us David R. George III, who has kicked off the massive new series for the 24th century, The Fall, with Revelation and Dust. Now, this is the first novel in the Star Trek Fall miniseries that centers around the Federation, the Typhon Pact, and, of course, the 24th century. And it's also the focus of this novel is the brand new Deep Space Nine. Now, David was responsible for destroying the original Deep Space Nine in Plagues of Night.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. That's right, folks. We're going to go there tonight because there's going to be some big things to talk about. Now, I want to encourage you, as David says, if you have not read this book, Revelations and Dust, please know that we are going to talk about some major things that happen in this book, because this is where we get a chance to talk to the author and ask him about those kind of things. So do not spoil yourself. Go read the book first and then come back and listen to the audio file here with the interview. So this book has some amazing things that happen. One, the brand new Deep Space Nine becomes operational, and there's an event that will shake the people of the Federation to their core. And so David, one of the things that we were just talking about right before we started recording is probably one of the hardest things I think that a Star Trek author, and especially one that's writing in Deep Space Nine. Now, Chris and I have been going through and doing the Deep Space Nine relaunch from the beginning. And so that was, what, 10, 12 years ago when that started?
Yeah, and something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
The series went off the air in 1999, so it was shortly after that, yeah.
And so right after that, you know, we got Avatar 1 and 2. We were talking about just the fact of how difficult it is for the author and then people like me who and Chris who have been reading these books since they started to kind of remember all that's happened. And you've been really tasked with, you know, with Rough Beasts of Empire, Plagues of Night, Rays of the Dawn to really continue on Deep Space Nine because it had kind of fallen by the wayside for a while. One, I just wanted to know first, what is it like to have to pick up all these story elements? And especially when we really lost a lot of time in Deep Space Nine, what's it like to try and put that together for the readers, have it make sense, but also carry the story forward?
It can be daunting. In fact, it's now that I think about it, it's more than 10 years since Avatar. I think Avatar was in 2000. Maybe 2001, so it's 12 or 13 years that we're talking about. And really, that can be daunting for a reader, but it shouldn't be. And it shouldn't be because it's got to be daunting for the writer, because the writer has a job to do. And that job is to make sure that a reader who picks up their book cold can follow along and know everything that's going on without having just read all the other books or even having read them at all. It's my job as a writer to make sure that the reader can follow along. Now, presumably, if they read the books that came before, they'll get a larger experience, a more enjoyable experience. But you have to make sure that when they pick up your book and read it, that they can follow all that. Now, they might be surprised that certain characters are in certain places or certain situations, but everything should be either explicitly explained or should be able to be understood implicitly. So really, it should be more daunting for a writer than for a reader, because the writer has to make sure that the reader can follow along. And it's a lot of history to go over, too.
It is.
But you know what? It's in a way, it's no different than the TV show, because, you know, in a way, because the seventh season episode, let's say, can make reference to a first season episode. Well, you can't assume that the reader, that the viewer just watched that first season episode, so you have to give the information that's relevant in the later episode. Now, that might come in the form of a previously on Deep Space Nine segment, or it could be incorporated into the episode through dialogue or whatever method. So, we have to do the same sorts of things.
Well, and then especially with, I was just thinking about The Fall, you know, and the series, and I feel like that this has really kind of been something that's been building since, in some ways, 2005 with Articles of the Federation. You have the whole coming together of the Time 2 series, which led into some more Next Generation books, which led into this, you know, massive book, Articles of the Federation by Keith. He introduces us to Tobacco and gives us this amazing character. And really through that, everything just flows out of that, you know. Then you get Destiny, and then you get the Typhon Pact and all this stuff really working together. So for you guys, what was the genesis of this series?
You know, I'd like to say that it all you know, Keith and company had it all mapped out from 2005 on, but of course that's not true. But what happens when we start writing, when we start trying, we knew we were going to do an event at the end of 2013, and the editor decided which writers they were going to work with, and we all got together and did a little brainstorming. And of course, it isn't that the plan for the character of President Bacco, for example, was decided in 2005. But the fact is that she's been a character for these 8 years, and she's got a lot of backstory now, and readers know her. And so now we can take that character and project forward. What would be an interesting thing to happen next? What would be a good story? What follows? What would follow from what's happened before? So we're just, we didn't have it planned all along, but we are using what came before and deciding what we would like to see in terms of dramatic story and what would satisfy the goals we have for the series, which is engaging readers, of course, and moving the universe forward in a certain way. So, it's a pretty involved process, and I think the editor came to us with a particular notion that we expanded on and came up with the overall idea for the entire series.
Can you mention at all what they had kind of wanted you to do?
Okay, this is the spoiler alert part of things. I think the editor came to us with, initially had the notion of perhaps we would have an Archduke Ferdinand moment, which is to say, you know, when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated, it actually spurred World War I. And so there was this idea that perhaps having an event like that in the Star Trek universe would be a good launching point for a series, this particular series, which eventually became The Fall. And from that, as a jumping off point, we decided where that could go. And of course, I'm not going to talk about where it can go, because the second book is out now, which is
more books to come.
The Crimson Shadow, but there are three to come. So yeah, I'm not going to go into detail for that. But obviously, we have that moment which occurs in my book that is a precursor for what follows in these the following four books. So we started from there and just mapped it out, and hopefully we think we have a good story, and hopefully the readers will think so too.
Wow, that's so you guys, because it's interesting, because one of Una's Typhon Pact books was Brinkmanship, and really has this whole, and in the Typhon Pact against the Federation, it's very Cold War feel to it. And then you guys now throwing in kind of the World War I reference. I like the mixture of real type of history, but mixing it up and you know, putting it in a blender and coming out with what's happening now in the 24th century universe.
Well, you certainly don't want to be predictable either. So, I mean, it's okay to make analogies to actual historic events, and you could even follow them completely, and that could be interesting and great. But you could also, as you say, mix them up and come up with different outcomes. So, and in my book, I'll let you ask the questions. I don't want to...
Hey, David, yeah, you can talk as much as you want, but I was going to see, you know, so you are tasked with the very first book, which I think probably is one of the hardest things to do, because you kind of have to lay out the framework for everything that's going to kind of, you know, you're planting all the seeds for what's going to come next. But also, you know, as we talked before, when we talked about, Plagues of Night and Raise the Dawn, that you are also really going to be using this is planting seeds for what's going to happen next in Deep Space Nine. So just tell me what it's like to set up the series and then also, you know, try and make your book enough that it's standalone, that people feel like they can read it and get, you know, a conclusion enough at the end so they're not just completely left hanging. And what's that all like? Because that's a big responsibility.
Well, I felt the weight of that responsibility because not so much because I had to set up what followed. I had done that before in Twilight, which was the first of the Mission Gamma series. So I understand what the responsibilities are of that. But I felt as though I was serving several different masters with this book. Yes, on the one hand, I had to set up the Fall series. I had cracked that nut and had to start out and with certain events and had to seed things for the other writers. But I also had to build the new Deep Space Nine. As we've already spoiled in previous books, Deep Space Nine, or the erstwhile Terek Nor, the first space station by the wormhole, was destroyed. And so Starfleet has built a new Deep Space Nine in the Bajoran system. And this is the first novel in which we get to see that space station. That means... Whereas before, you could tell the story on an environment in an environment that the reader was used to. Now you don't have that, so you have to create it from scratch. That's a huge responsibility. First of all, you have to make a lot of decisions, like what is this space station going to look like? How is it going to be different from the previous one? What are the improvements? What makes sense for this in the 24th century? What are things that that are difficult to think of that you want to come up with. And so I had a second responsibility, in addition to setting up the Fall series. More even than that, I had the third, on the third hand, and this is science fiction, so there's certainly a third hand, I had to continue the Deep Space Nine story. Well, I mean, I guess I suppose I didn't have to, but I wanted to. I thought I had to because... We've had all of these Deep Space Nine books, and Raise the Dawn ends, though it tells a complete story, it also ends with some story elements unresolved. And so I felt like I needed to resolve, you know, some of that and also set up future Deep Space Nine stories. So I really had three tasks, and that did add to the complexity and challenge of the novel.
And for you, then, with... that kind of complexity and everything, especially with in reference to the new Deep Space Nine, what's it like? I mean, you're having to basically create, I mean, you know what the outside of the station looks like because of what's been done. But I mean, you're having to create, it seems like in your mind, everything that goes on and what the inside of the station looks like. So,
well, in fact, I didn't exactly know what the outside of the station looked like. I mean, I had an idea because... Mm-hmm. I realized at the end of Raise the Dawn that I needed to, I had to set a scene that really did, at least in a rudimentary fashion, describe the outside of the station. And so I did that in Raise the Dawn. I tried to be relatively vague, although I gave enough detail that it would mean something to the readers. Mm-hmm. But I knew that it was going to be the next novel that introduced the new Deep Space Nine. So I wanted to make sure that whoever the next writer was, could have been me, could have been somebody else, had some leeway. And when I started writing the novel, writing this novel, Revelation and Dust, I needed to, since it turned out to be me who wrote that novel, I needed to actually then decide on the actual outside of the station, the all the details. And then, of course, yes, I had to create the inside of the station as well. Now, I recognize that you're not going to go every square meter within the station, and you still need to leave room for other writers to be able to add to the description and come up with other things. But I needed for the readers to understand a good chunk of what the new Deep Space Nine looked like and how it functioned and all of that. And I was fortunate enough that I was really hoping that we could get an image of this. And I went to my editors and I said, you know, I asked if we could get something on the cover. And they were good enough to turn that task over to Doug Drexler, who was an Academy Award-winning and Emmy Award-winning artist who worked on the modern-day Star Trek series. And he, in turn, went to Andrew J. Probert and Douglas Graves, who are digital model makers, and they worked together to create the image of the station, and then Doug Drexler worked to create the cover, and I worked through Doug Drexler with he was the go-between between myself and the model makers, and they also had their own artistic visions that they needed to satisfy. I mean, I had my artistic vision, they had their artistic visions. They did not always jibe, but they were close enough. And we actually had, because I'd written in Raise the Dawn, that rudimentary description of the station, we had a basis from which to proceed. So there was some back and forth, and I made some concessions. They made some concessions. I mean, that is, they compromised on what their ideas were, what my ideas were. They had some great ideas, too, that I hadn't thought of, and so I was very, very satisfied with the end result. I thought they did a great job, and I thought Doug produced a fantastic cover.
Oh, he did. Yeah. The result of the collaboration is absolutely beautiful. I love the fact that it feels Starfleet, but you can definitely see the inspiration from the original station in it.
It was really interesting, because I thought it should not, the station should, in a vague way, evoke the old Deep Space Nine, but only in a vague way, and Doug Drexler felt it should be more like the old Deep Space Nine. So we tried to find, you know, somewhere in the middle that we could meet on that, and, you know, we want it to be brand new, but also, you know, have some air of familiarity about it. But certainly, we're talking about replacing a station that in-universe was 50 plus years old, or 60 years, whatever it was, and constructed as an ore processing station. So necessarily, what we replace it with will be more modern. It will be for a different function and a different initial function in being a starbase and not to process ore. So you wanted it to be different. It needed to be different.
Well, it feels to me like architecturally, of course, it feels Starfleet, but it also makes me feel like, say, here on Earth, anything that we create, you know, after a number of decades go by, our approach to things evolves, and it feels like an evolution for Starfleet as well in the way that they build a starbase. It feels like it's like Starbase 2.0, 3.0, whatever. It's like it's an upgrade for Starfleet, even.
Well, I'm glad that came across, because that was sort of one of the things that I was going for. You wanted it to be an evolution in Starfleet's construction to starbases. Mm-hmm. It should be something brand new. And because it's an important station, because it's in an important location, it really needed to be, I thought, a grand station. They would not have chosen to create Terek Nor. They would have made something, Starfleet would have constructed something bigger and better, and that's what I think they did here. That's what I wanted to convey that they did here.
One of the things I was wondering while I was reading the book was, did you have Doug or anyone help you kind of figure out what the layout inside looked like? So you kind of had a picture in your mind. So when you were writing, you know, you had an idea of how it all, you know, where the hub is and where the new plaza is and where the memorial is and all these things, so that you could kind of picture in your mind when you're writing. Because, you know, writing Deep Space Nine, you're very familiar with exactly what the station looks like. You know, and everybody who's reading can do that immediately. You know, oh, we're in the promenade, or oh, we're in the quarters, or, you know, oh, we're in the cargo bays. You know, it's very simple. But now you have this whole new task of, you know, creating something that we've never really seen inside. And so you're having to try and describe it. And I'm sure you're having to do that for yourself. Did you get any pictures of what the layout looks like in the parts you were describing at all?
Well, I described the parts before I got pictures of them. So I actually was giving my descriptions to the artists.
Okay.
And they were coming back. Now, that said, most of the stuff therefore originated with me, but that doesn't mean it stayed the way I originated it. For example, initially it makes no sense from a military standpoint to have the bridge of a starship that may go into battle mm-hmm. on the very top of the ship.
right.
Exposed. It makes no sense. However, this is Star Trek, and this is what we do, and it's for artistic reasons, and you could try and come up with an in-universe reason of, look, we're not people who hide or whatever. But I decided early on that the new control center for Deep Space Nine was not going to be easily vulnerable by being, you know, outside, exposed on the top of the station. And so I buried it at the very center of Deep Space Nine, and I called it the core, which I loved. I thought that was a great name for the control center, the core. And Doug Drexler and Andy Probert and Doug Graves provided, I don't remember the exact sequence of things, but at some point, not that I'm a great artist or anything, but I created, for my own reference, I created a blueprint of the core.
Okay.
What it looked like, where each of the stations were, I created that, and then I sent that off to the artists, just so they would have an idea of what I was writing. Not that they were going to produce a picture of that or anything, but I don't remember exactly how this happened, but somewhere along their input made me relocate the core, which once I moved it out of the very center of the space station, I felt I could no longer call the core because it just didn't work. But I moved it once again to the top of the station. And I did it because the exterior that they created made that control center that I had created, that blueprint, it just fit physically perfectly at the top of the station, where there are four rings there are two rings that come together, so
they're like the pylons on the old station.
Yeah, together. And there are two rings, but yeah. that means that each ring has, you know, they meet four structures meet at, it's two rings, but four four arcs meet at a point at the top of the station. It was just mm-hmm. the perfect place because the control center had four turbo lifts. It was perfect up there. So I relocated it up there and decided to call it the hub because that's what it was. And it just made more sense. So even though a lot of the stuff originated with me, we went back and forth, the artists and I went back and forth, and they absolutely provided inspiration to change things and had better ideas and got me to they weren't trying to get me to change things, but they did because, you know, they had great ideas and great artistic visions. Mm-hmm. They also did a fantastic job with the memorial.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I had an idea about, and I seem to think that I didn't have an idea where we were going to locate it, and they put it beneath the hub, although not accessible from the hub, they put it beneath it, and it was just the perfect place for it. And so there were lots of things like that, but everything sort of originated with me in terms of, I mean, I was writing the novel. I had to know where things were in the station. So, just the description, in some cases they changed the places, like I said, but in some cases I did have to change descriptions because they suggested, for the plaza, they had the residential area visible from the commercial area, and I saw pictures of that and it worked, so I changed what I had written to match those drawings. So it was very collaborative, and I had to know exactly what I was writing from the get-go, because
right.
If I don't know it, if I'm vague about it to the readers, they're going to be lost.
Right, exactly. Well, and I remember just reading through the book, I would reread some of those descriptions a few times, because I'm just trying to, you know, really mentally picture, okay, what's this new, you know, Deep Space Nine look like? Any chance at all? I know that you really want us to get to see the station. I'm so glad that your dream came true and that they put it on the cover of a couple of the books, yours and then David Mack. So both Davids have the new DS9 on their cover. But any chance that we'll see this maybe on StarTrek.com or, you know, the Star Trek magazine, where we'll have a more in-depth look at the brand new Deep Space Nine and maybe get inside what the hub looks like? And
you know, that would be fantastic, and I would love for that to happen, but I don't know that that's going to happen. Of course, anything like that costs money, because people have to do it, people have to publish it. I mean, they could even have fold-out plans or whatever in a novel, but all of this costs money, so... that's not my call to make. I was very grateful that they managed to get Doug Drexler involved for my cover, because that's an expense as well. So I don't know that that's going to happen. I'm hopeful that the Deep Space Nine books, and while this is the first book of the fall series, it's still a Deep Space Nine novel, clearly. The Deep Space Nine novels have to sell well if they're going to keep being published. And as a reader, not as a writer, but as a reader, I hope that that happens. I mean, as a writer, obviously I want my books to sell well. But even if I don't write any more Deep Space Nine novels, I still want to read them, because I have loved all of the books that have followed along since the end of the show.
Oh, yeah. Agreed.
So if they continue to sell, then... At some point, you'd hope somewhere there would be Deep Space Nine blueprints, you know, somewhere in on Star Trek Online or in a fold-out in a novel or somewhere, you know.
Right. What we need is, after seeing the inside now of Larry's new Stellar Cartography book, which is not really a book so much, something like that, that instead of maps, they were blueprints of the new TS9. That would be, I think, a dream come true for most of us Niners.
Well, if you come over to my house, I can open up, you know, some of my documents and show you what I'm
right.
with.
Okay, we'll bring the beer.
Yeah, we're bringing the drinks. No, I love that, and I think how much Doug loves getting to design this stuff. I can't imagine that they'd have to twist his arm too much to have him do that. So hopefully, people will buy the books, and you know, I loved that beforehand on StarTrek.com that they really did play this up, that, hey, this is the new Deep Space Nine, this is what it looks like. I love that they did that, and so hopefully that'll continue.
Yeah, I was happy about that, too, and Doug's great. Easy, so professional, easy to work with, and clearly great at what he does, just a fantastic artist. I couldn't have been happier with the outcome.
Well, you know, this is where we're really going to talk some serious spoilers. And so, again, if you haven't, we haven't really completely spoiled this book yet, but we're about to, fans. So so get ready. But so, David, we talked about that in Articles of the Federation, Keith created probably one of the most beloved novel characters for Star Trek that's ever been created. I think universally, I don't know anybody that I know in fandom online, you know, that I've met that doesn't like President Bacco. I think she just, as far as I can tell, she's become one of the most popular characters that, you know, never existed in Star Trek that we saw on screen, but, you know, somebody wrote her in a novel and became really, I loved her from the minute she was on. I thought she was fabulous.
Well,
so,
I agree with you in terms of loving the character. I've loved the character from the beginning. I love reading her. I love writing her. She's a joy to write. But I have to disagree with it being universal among fandom that beloved, because first of all, nothing's universal. Just on general principles, nothing's universal. But the first review I saw on this novel that I just wrote was not only a negative review, but it was also in the review, the reader declared that they absolutely despised the background.
Nice.
And, you know, that's going to happen. That's just the way it is. It's all subjective, and, you know, who knows why. You try and create a character that people will like if that's what your goal is, and, you know, it's not always going to work. But, yeah, plenty of people certainly do love President Bacow, and I'm one of them.
So, you know, how then for you hard was it to have to write her assassination? And did you talk to Keith at all beforehand and let him know, hey, I'm gonna kill her. Sorry.
When we first talked about, as I mentioned, this Archduke Ferdinand moment, clearly that's a reference to the assassination of the Archduke that instigated World War One, a real event. We were talking about killing, he could have killed the Romulan Praetor, I assume, or somebody else. But really, you know, it made the most sense to think about doing it with President Bacow, to assassinating her. And initially, I was really on board. I just thought, great story point. Scenes like that are typically fun to write because they're dramatic, and, you know, how can you fail that, you know? But yeah, as I started to plot it all out, it really started to bother me, because I love President Bacow. I love reading her. I love writing her. And I wasn't alone. There are plenty of other writers who really enjoy writing the character, and I feel like I have contributed in some part to her overall character, because I've written her a number of times. I'm not the only one, certainly. Obviously, Keith created her. Dave Max written her. I mean, you know, there are plenty of writers who have written the character, but it just started to be just really difficult when I got to even just plotting it, before I'd even gotten to the scene where I would actually have the assassination. And I think in part that was not just because I liked the character and maybe didn't want to see her go, but also because when I thought about it, I thought about the assassination of President Kennedy.
Yes.
And you know, I've read so much about how it impacted our nation, about how the country was just devastated by it, and really a lot of the rest of the world as well. And you think about some traumatic public event like that, and in my lifetime, you think about September 11th attacks.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm a native New Yorker. I wasn't in New York at the time of the attacks, but I'm a native New Yorker. And I know how that felt, how just really traumatic this event was, that really wasn't, in a sense, a personal event for me, but it was this public event that just sort of impacted all of us. And as the French said, you know, that day, we are all New Yorkers. It just was something that was devastating. And I thought about all of that, because in universe, if the Federation president is assassinated, it's going to devastate people. It's going to have this just terrible, traumatic, emotional impact. And I, all of a sudden, maybe this wasn't going to be so fun to write.
And I think it really does. I mean, I saw it coming. And I was like, no, he's not. He's really, no, David won't do this. This isn't David Mack. He doesn't kill people like this. And then I realized that what was going to happen, it was rough, because I have grown to love the character. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Praetor, and I would have felt just as badly if she had died as well, because I've grown very fond of finally a Romulan who isn't just a conniving, you know, horrible person. Because I feel like a lot of times Star Trek kind of gets caught in making all the characters the same for a race.
Sure. I mean, it's funny, because Star Trek, which espouses inclusiveness and is so opposed to to generalizing individuals constantly does it. And it not because it believe, not because those are the mores that it's trying to get across, but just because that's an easy way to do things in a television show. All Klingons right. are this. All Romulans are this, you know, until you get to the one Klingon who's not like that and you actually tell that story. So, yeah, right. we often end up painting entire races with just one brush. So, yeah, I love the Praetor, too. And, you know, she was there. The Praetor, mm-hmm. the Romulan leader, was yes. at the dedication with President Bacco and the Klingon chancellor and the Gorn leader and the you know, all of these other leaders, because while I was foreshadowing something bad happening, I wanted readers to not be sure if somebody was going to get gunned down that they weren't sure who
right.
it was going to be.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons that we had you know, this setting of this dedication that included multiple leaders from throughout the Federation and beyond.
Well, it was such a good, I mean, honestly, just a great pickup from what David had done in Silent Weapons, with Bacco meeting with the Praetor, meeting with the Imperator from
the Gorn.
Just fantastic that to just kind of see how that's all been working together. And I love that you guys just, you know, picking that up and really moving that forward and seeing the interconnectedness of the stories. Really paying off. And like you said, just one of those things that if you've read all the books, you really do get the joy of seeing how this all plays out. And so for me, well done, because, you know, I thought it would be Bacco, but you know, the whole scene, you were kind of waiting, okay, who's going to get shot in this lineup?
yeah, it felt like I tried to convey that something was going to happen, something was building. I tried to give that feel, I've gotten a number of emails from people who read the book who were staggered by Bacco's assassination, many of whom were also saddened by it because they too loved the character. I got a great email just the other night from somebody who said that they couldn't believe that I did that, that they were just angry that it happened and that they loved it.
Yes.
And I thought, wow, now that's one of the better fan letters I've ever gotten.
Yeah, right.
You want to challenge readers too. Like I said, I'm not just challenging myself, I'm challenging, and that was a challenge, that scene, because I said as I got to it, it actually was very emotional, not just because I love the character, but because, you know, I'm relating it to other things that have happened, not just in my life, but in you know, throughout history.
Yeah.
These are, you know, not typically great things to happen. And I kept imagining how the people of the Federation were just going to be devastated by this.
Yeah. And you know, I think for anyone who has been reading Star Trek books for a while, and even if you don't like the character, it's a big watershed moment for everything that's been building with the Typhon Pact, and for, you know, since, you know, really 2005, since you kind of had the introduction of the Articles of the Federation. You had Singular Destiny, which carried that on after Destiny series, and so really building this whole part of that Star Trek world and making it very real for us who've been reading the books, and then to have this happen again just makes it a really real event in a lot of ways. And so
I mean, it's interesting, because who would have thought that the Federation political environment would become fodder for so many stories. I mean, we'd gone through Star Trek for a long time without really dealing with it, with just having essentially passing references to it or a scene here or there. And yet, you know, over the last decade, it really has become very, very real and a much used part of the universe. And I've loved using her, and I can't imagine not using her, because you know, some of the stories I told ended up being very political, and you just, you know, you need that governmental mechanism to be there.
Yeah, it makes the world of Star Trek feel more real to me.
Oh, good. Well, it's always good to hear. Yeah,
I would have voted for her for president. So
yeah, well, yeah. we tried to make her a good person. You know, we tried to make her somebody who wanted to do right for right's sake, you don't do the right thing because it's easy. You do the right thing because it's right.
Yeah.
And I liked people around her too. And I liked,
yes,
political arguments, let's say, where there are opposing views, because you have to make both opposing views. If you want to write a successful scene, you have to write both opposing views as if they're valid. The people who believe in them, who are espousing a particular view, have to absolutely believe in it, and they absolutely have to have good reasons. I mean, you could just write somebody who's stupid or who's selfish, but that's kind of boring.
Right.
You want the areas that are sort of shades of gray, and you want somebody that you agree with to be able to make an argument that you believe in, but the other side to also make an argument that you at least stop and say, well, you know, there's some truth to that too. And you know, so I like writing those. I like, you know, her cabinet didn't always agree with her, and there were arguments about what they should do. And it's also good to see a leader taking in other opinions and then arriving at a conclusion.
Right.
You know, somebody who's actually leading.
Definitely.
And that's I think one of the things that made her a really fascinating character, and something that will be missed now in that 24th century universe. I think people with her gone are gonna you know, think every once in a while when they're reading a new novel, man, I just wish Bacco was around. Things would probably be better right now if she was here. So,
well, you know, you say that, but one of the things that's interesting about Bacco is while she presided over the ultimate vanquishing of the Borg, for example, clearly a positive watershed moment in Federation history, she also presided over the secession of one of the founding members of the Federation. So,
this is true.
And she felt that loss of Andor heavily, too.
Mm-hmm.
And she, I think even in Revelation and Dust, she was wondering to herself how our presidency was going to be, or maybe it was Raise the Dawn. I don't know, somewhere along the way, she was wondering whether she was going to be remembered for being the president who lost Andor, you know, and be reviled and labeled a failure in history because of that. So, interesting character.
Well, there's a whole other side to the book, and that is where you picked up what happens to Kira after Raise the Dawn, where we realize that she's not dead, she's somehow in the Celestial Temple, and she's locked there because the wormhole has closed itself. And so her first experience was, I thought, and honestly, David, I was at work reading and reading through Sisko's experience as she's watching it was a really moving experience to see that again, from a with somebody else watching this time.
Mm-hmm.
And just remembering how good Emissary was and how really important that story was, because it was such a beautiful story of human suffering, moving on, what it means to be human, what it means to be corporeal. I mean, just a really fantastic story. And so you have Kira get to see this first encounter that Sisko has with the prophets.
Steal from the best.
And why did you have her start there?
A couple reasons. This was, you know, I said earlier that I had the three tasks. One was to create the new Deep Space Nine. One was to start the fall. And the other was to continue the Deep Space Nine story. The fourth thing I had to do, that was in the back of my mind, was, hey, this is the 20th anniversary of the premiere of Deep Space Nine. What are we going to do about that? And I saw a way to do that by recapitulating the Sisko's experiences in the Celestial Temple in the very first episode. However, that's not the only reason I did it. There is, Kira sees this. She witnesses what the Emissary went through for a specific reason, because there's information that the prophets wanted to impart to her, and they did. And I may have been a little too subtle about it. I was worried for a long time that I wasn't being subtle enough. Now I'm pondering whether or not I've been too subtle. But there's information in that that's conveyed to Kira. She doesn't harp on it, but she recognizes that information. And presumably in the future, she will take action based on that information. But that was actually the whole Kira story. I mean, it starts there. It starts with her. The end of Raise the Dawn, the wormhole has collapsed with her in it. But we're pretty sure that she's not dead because she's been essentially rescued by the last vestiges of the spirit of Elias Vaughn, which clearly is something the prophets have set in motion. And so this novel starts with her in the Celestial Temple, and she sees Sisko's first experience with the prophets, and then her story continues. And that actually, I would say, while the Deep Space Nine anniversary aspect of it was maybe the D part of the story, and creating the new Deep Space Nine was the C start part of the story, and the assassination was the B part of the story. The A part of the story is Kira's experiences in within the Celestial Temple. This is the story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Of course, there are unresolved questions at the end, but this story of her within the wormhole is really the focus of the book, which I think maybe some people think that it was actually the Deep Space Nine stuff, which makes sense, but really it was seeing Kira through her experiences within the wormhole.
So there, I really got the picture that through this life that she lives in the past, that in some way it was almost like the prophets were having her be part of their reconstruction of their temple that's been damaged in some way. And
oh, I'm glad that you picked up on that. Again, I was worried at some point that I wasn't being subtle enough, and now I think maybe some readers haven't actually seen what you saw, which is that at least part of Kira's experiences resulted in the prophets using her corporeality, her actual physical being, her physical essence, to help them rebuild the Celestial Temple. And you see this within her experiences, her in Bajor's past, rebuilding the tunnel through the mountains, which after she comes out of that, she sees that at the same time she's also, at least in her vision, see that she's built a bridge across a chasm. And then, you know, she's whisked away and you realize, okay, the wormhole has also been rebuilt. So that's all of a piece that the prophets used Kira to help them rebuild the temple.
Which I thought was really interesting because, you know, at the beginning, I was like, okay, well, I know David has a reason for telling us this story because the prophets don't really do anything by accident. And it was about halfway through the book, I realized what they were doing is that they were having her, you know, be a part of this rebuilding. But at the same time, you made it very real when the very end of the book, who pops out of the, you know, the tear of the prophet is not Kira.
Right.
Who's still there.
You thought it was going to be Kira, though, right?
And I was like, this is it. This is how she returns. I love that. And then I was like, what the heck? David, come on.
I love that.
You got me. I was, you can tell us about Altec and what he's doing?
It's fascinating because you're given to understand. I mean, it seems like maybe what Kira is experiencing is analogous to what Sisko experienced when he went back to Earth in the 50s.
And, right.
You know, far beyond the stars when he was Benny Russell.
Mm.
So you think, okay, she's in a vision, and it's an historical vision like, you know, Sisko in 50s New York. And then, you know, all of a sudden, one of the people that she had contact with back in this you think Vision also all of a sudden is there in the real universe. So what does this mean? Have the prophets created this person? Is this person somebody else who's modeled on this person? Is it a descendant? Is it the actual person? Was Kira actually back in history? These are all good questions. And they're meant to leave you wanting to find out the answers. I mean, it's part and parcel of Deep Space Nine to wrap up some threads and start others.
Right.
clearly, this is the jumping off point for what would follow. I'd love hearing that, you know, you expected one thing and got something else, and what the hell does that mean? And that's what I was going for. You know, I wanted it to be a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, and then, of course, the very next scene, she runs into Tyranitar, and he's supposed to be dead. And, of course, anybody in Deep Space Nine, we all know, can come back when you're dealing with the prophets. And so, I'm ready.
Good. Well, and I have to say, I am not of the opinion that dead characters should come back. Now, I'm not saying this is a blanket statement. I know what David Mack did was brilliant, and what Kirsten Beyer did was fantastic. As a general rule for myself, when I kill somebody, I want them to stay dead. That's why I killed them in the first place. So you have to ask yourself, is that really Tyranitar? Tyranitar, was he really dead? Did he really die? What time frame is Kira in? I mean, there are all sorts of questions to ask that require answers, and I hope that they'll be forthcoming.
Yes, I'm with you. I definitely hope that we will get the answers, because I feel like I feel like you're doing that wonderful thing that writers like to do on TV, where they are twisting the arm of the studio to give them another season.
Sending Alf home, but not actually finishing the story.
Exactly. And so hopefully they will really want to continue this, because I think you've set up, you know, just another great Deep Space Nine mystery that has to do with the prophets. I mean, you even set up two, which it's subtle, but it's there, Rebecca, and the fact you know, obviously she has a connection with the prophets that Sisko and Cassidy are probably not going to be happy about when they figure that out.
I was hoping that things like that, and it's my belief that things like that they honor Deep Space Nine. They try and do what Deep Space Nine did as a television series. I thought Marco Palmieri was the editor initially, who started the literary Deep Space Nine following from the end of the show, did a great job just trying to. Not just tell Deep Space Nine stories, but tell them in similar ways to the show. Now, obviously, they're different formats, so they have different requirements, but the hallmark of Deep Space Nine was change. I mean, everything changed. I mean, Julian Bashir is a naive, wet behind the ears, fresh out of the academy doctor. Oh, no, wait, he's actually genetically engineered and a super genius.
Gotcha. He was fooling us all.
All the time.
Yeah,
and so I like that aspect of Deep Space Nine, that there are all these different layers to things and different twists and turns that things take, and you know, Deep Space Nine would set up storylines in one season, not pay them off till the next season or the season after, and you know, it's important to keep paying things off as you go along. You don't want to just continually ask questions.
Battlestar Galactica.
I'm such a bad nerd. I've never seen
Battlestar Lost.
Galactica.
Or yeah, Lost. Yeah,
Lost. So let's just make it up as we go, and who cares if we ever explain anything?
So, I have ideas. I have good ideas. I mean, I hope they're good ideas, but I have pretty well defined ideas of where the story can go from here. But who knows if I'm going to be the one to write the next novel? If there's even going to be a next novel? I mean. That part of the novel, the Deep Space Nine part of the novel, the Kira part of the novel, is really I mean, that's the Deep Space Nine threat. The Fall is not a Deep Space Nine series. It's Next Generation right. and Titan. And, you know, there are certainly Deep Space Nine elements in it, in the other four books. But the Deep Space Nine aspect of my novel is going, you know, that will continue beyond the Fall. Those issues are going to be dealt with in the Fall. What's being dealt with in the Fall is essentially, you know, the fallout, if you will, of the right. Bacco assassination. For one thing, you know, who did it? And we're given two suspects, a specific and a generic suspect in my mm-hmm. novel. And the question is whether either or both or neither of them did it, and who actually did, and what's going to be the repercussions of once the identity assassin is found out, if it's found out.
This is your who shot JR moment. You set it up exactly. with an Archduke Ferdinand moment. This is who shot JR.
That's right. That, although there will be no showers in the rest of the series.
Well, we've got, Kirsten does Voyager. So I say that they should just give you Deep Space Nine and allow you to continue.
I'd certainly be happy.
Let's get Pocket on the phone right now make sure that this happens.
Well, you know, buy more books. that's the only thing that can. Well, I mean, and you know what? If it's me, great. I'm happy to do it. I love Deep Space Nine. I love writing these novels. But there are certainly other terrific novelists working in the Star Trek universe right now, and so I'm sure there obviously yes. are terrific novelists who aren't yet working in the Star Trek universe who certainly could. But you know, I'm a big David Mack fan in terms of his writing. Kirsten Beyer, James Swallow, Una McCormack is terrific. Dayton Ward, Kevin Dillmore. I mean, there's some great, very talented
yes.
people out there.
Yes.
And I mean, the Star Trek readership should be very happy. And Margaret Clark, who's one of the editors, and she's doing a terrific job. And is, I think, a fine steward for the Star Trek line. I think they'll continue to be good novels produced as long as, you know, those people are in charge of things.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, Chris and I, you know, do this show is and we love to have the authors on and give you guys a voice because we want more people reading the books. And especially now where it's the only place that we get to see this prime universe unfold and you guys now can do pretty much whatever you want. And it's so much fun to be able to read that universe. So just appreciate getting to do that because what you guys write is fantastic. You keep writing great stuff and we just want to give you a place to come talk about it so that more people will buy more books.
Hey,
so
I'm happy to have a place to talk about it. I'm happy to have the jobs. But you know, it's also a nice professional community. I mentioned Margaret Clark. There's also Ed Schlesinger, who's another editor who's working on the Star Trek line. They really do a fine job of just shepherding us along the path. And all these writers that we have are, you know, I had to work with Una and Dave Mack and James Swallow and Dayton Ward for this series. You know, we often go to the editor with questions and issues, but frequently enough we'll go to each other just because it's easier. And all fantastic people to work with. So, you know, we're all happy here, you know, if only everybody thought the way you thought, we'd be very happy.
Well, David, just a couple more things. One, I wanted to say I really loved, and as I was saying earlier, you know, reading Sisko's story again and from Emissary was a really moving experience. And I literally sitting there at work at my desk on my break, trying to kind of choke back some tears because it's such a really important human thing to learn is how to move on from something traumatic that's happened and how to do that. And Sisko learning that and being able to watch that over and over again, what a just a fantastic lesson that's timeless. And
well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. But the one of the points of that scene, though, too, is that, you know, the way you felt. Now, you had seen it initially, but Kira hadn't. Right.
Yeah.
But Kira's seeing this for the first time. And now she's considering, you know, her, the somebody she views as the emissary somebody who was her commanding officer, but somebody also who was her friend. And now she's seeing a part of his development that while she might have understood it, you know, on the periphery, I mean, they had just met when this happened, so she might have understood that something happened on the periphery of his life. She wasn't there when his wife died. She wasn't there for the 3 years that followed. So all of this stuff is, and to see his tremendous sorrow and see that the prophets had really helped him move on, this is all new to her. And so this allows her to see an aspect of her friend she didn't really know.
Yeah.
So it's I'm glad that you enjoyed it. And but the part of the reason for this scene is not so that Kira would enjoy it, but so that she would understand Sisko better. And also, you know, like I say, the prophets give her some information. So I had fun writing that scene, too. It was fun to go back. It's such a fantastic episode.
Yeah. Well, and what I loved is that you pay that off. You're not just doing it for, you know, to bring us backward. But I really like the way that it pays off in the sense that the entire Federation now is faced with this issue of where Sisko was because the president has just been assassinated. And do you get stuck where you are or do you find a way to move forward and do that well? And that's going to be the big, thing for the Federation to go through. Do we do this well or, you know, do we start a war like in World War One? You know, do we, what do we do and how do we move forward and how we deal with that is going to say a lot about who the Federation is and who it wants to be in the future.
Some respects too, Sendeska, the first officer on Deep Space Nine, and then Rolaren, the captain, they don't say it in quite the same way. They don't say it in that detail, but they talk about it too. They say, you know, Ro asks our first officer the question, you know, now what? I mean, you know, we just had the president of the Federation assassinated. Now what the hell do we do? And he says, you know, we do what we Bajorans have always done. And of course, they're in the context of having just relatively recently come out of the decades-long occupation by the Cardassians. He says, we do what we always do. We carry on. We have to move forward. And Rolaren later echoes that. Now, they're not echoing it from the perspective of Kira having watched the Sisko's experience, but for the reader, that echo should be there. That as you picked up on that the question is, you know, Sisko had this terrible loss, and it was a terribly personal loss. This is a more public loss, but it still impacts people in a personal way. And you know, how do we move on?
Well, David, I want to really just thank you so much for coming on, and I want to give you an opportunity, one, to just let us know what's coming up next for you, what's out there that you've done. This is your spot to just kind of let everybody know what's going on with you and where people can follow you and all of those kind of things. I want you to give you your spot.
Okay, well, I actually just had I don't like this word, but technically a novelette came out I guess in August, Bob Greenberger and Aaron Rosenberg and Paul Kupperberger, three writers and editors who came up with a notion of a shared universe that they call Redeus. And the conceit of that universe is that at the 2012 Olympic Games in London, all the gods came back. Not the Christian God and but it's just all the pantheons of God. The Roman gods came back. The Native American gods came back.
I remember you talking about this a little bit last time you were on. Yeah, that this was.
Yeah,
coming
and they've had three anthologies. They've just published the third anthology, which is called Native Lands, and it takes place all in North America. The various stories, and I have one in there called the Instruments of Vice, which takes place actually in South Dakota and is just set within this world of where all the gods have come back. And actually it's a couple of decades down the line after their return. So I had that just came out. I'm actually working on a new Star Trek novel at the moment, which is in the Lost Era, which of course is the time frame between the end of Captain Kirk's Star Trek and the beginning of Captain Picard's The Next Generation. And so I've got a novel that should be out next summer, I believe, that in that time frame, and that's awfully fun. And people can follow me on Twitter at David R. George III. And I'm on Facebook, DRGIII, if they want to. I have a page for my writing there. So, and if you look hard enough, it's easy enough to find my email address if you feel that you need to contact me that way. So, and you know, I certainly hope that the Deep Space Nine books sell well enough to continue the line going forward. And certainly, I would love to return to that. And you know, I may go ahead and try and pitch some ideas I have for that going forward.
Well, we are definitely behind you in that, and hopefully that will happen, and hopefully everybody will, if you haven't already, pick up a copy of Revelation and Dust in the fall series. Also pick up Una's new book, The Crimson Shadow, which follows that.
Which is a terrific book, and I just found out today that it actually made the New York Times print paperback
awesome.
Bestseller list.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, that's great.
Which is
that's
fantastic.
Great.
Una's a terrific person and a terrific writer,
yes.
And so I'm really happy for her with that. And it's a great book. And then Dave Mack's book is A Ceremony of Losses, which follows Una's book. And then after that, James Swallow's The Poison Chalice. And mm-hmm. if the series concludes with Peyton Ward's Peaceable Kingdoms. And I've read them all and enjoyed them immensely. So hope
Excellent.
Everybody else will as well.
Well, David, thank you so much for coming on and just walking us through the beginning of the fall. And I can't wait to continue reading it and getting to talk to the rest of the authors as they come out. And so we really appreciate your time. And you're welcome back anytime to talk about anything that you would like, Deep Space Nine or Star Trek related. We just really appreciate you coming on.
I appreciate the invitation. Always a pleasure, guys.
Yeah, thanks so much, David. Appreciate it. Well, Matthew, I'm so glad David could join us today. You know, I really enjoyed this first book in the fall series. It's amazing. You know, as he talked about, we talked about how the politics play into things over the course of the books, and that is something I think is lacking in the television series, and it's understandable, but it really does make the world feel more real, like you're mm-hmm. really living in the Star Trek universe. And I'm glad David could join us and just find out kind of the thought process that went on there behind writing this book.
Yeah, I was telling my roommate that one of the favorite things that I get to do on the network is be able to interview the authors. And really, it's because it feels like getting to do the background information for a DVD, you know, or a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Right. We get to do those extras, and except we get it to do it with the books, and getting to interview any of the authors is just an honor. The fact that they want to come on and to our show and talk about what they do behind the scenes with their books and what their thought process was. And this was even more fantastic, obviously, Chris, for us being Niners and getting to hear the background information for creating the new Deep Space Nine.
He
couldn't really talk to us too much about it when he did Plagues of Night and Raised at Dawn, but now getting to have that all in the open, and I just can't wait. And I really do hope that Pocket will give him and other authors Deep Space Nine and just let them run again, because I feel like that's a series that does definitely need to continue. And as we've talked about many times, without Deep Space Nine's relaunch, I don't know if the book universe would exist the way it does in the first place. So I think it's only fair and right to allow it to continue. So hopefully it will.
It definitely does. Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, we talk a lot about DS9 on the network as well as other things. So if you enjoyed this show, here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network this week.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Once.
I think Sisko and Dukat, you know, in the best tradition of any kind of good writing, you know, the villain is a mirror, flipped mirror image of the hero, and that, you know, that's for Kirk and Khan and a whole bunch of great Star Trek. So, you know, you get Sisko and Dukat, and they have a lot in common with each other.
Earl Grey.
Jean-Luc Picard.
Because he's larger than life for 90% of the show. He is the captain. Okay, like, I'm going to ruffle some feathers right now. I'm just letting you guys know this is going to be controversial. But he is the captain that Sisko and Janeway wished they were.
The Ready Room.
The Voyager Conspiracy.
Now, Daniel and I were talking about this in a prior podcast about the 80s moment, and so I can see Seven coming up. In this episode, I tried to download too much information in your heads. Try not to study too much in school. Try to diverse yourselves. Play with your friends. Go see your family.
Information, too, can be a drug.
Just say no, kids.
To the journey!
Voyager's funniest moments.
They're seeing Sandrines for the first time, and you see that pool shark guy who is such a chauvinist pig jerk, who says something to the effect, to B'Elanna, something like, "Treat a lady like a tramp, and a tramp like a lady. It works every time." And she says, "Paris, did you program this guy?" And he's like, "Yeah, why?" She said, "He's a pig, and so are you."
Commentary, Trek stars.
Carnival.
But they are also dealing with essentially general supernatural metaphysical concepts that are not limited to Christianity. So implying that there's a heaven and a hell in this, I think, is limiting, because the show very clearly states that they are not playing by any simple rule book.
Warp 5.
Archer and the Prime Directive.
In and of itself, that doesn't make it the correct one. I mean, you could argue whether there is even such a thing as an absolute moral position. That is a moral position in itself, to say that we have moral absolutism versus moral relativism, and the Federation adopts a moral relativist position.
Trek news and views.
Andorians.
I don't think Shatner would have turned around and said, "Make sure one of them's an Andorian."
No, his special effects would have been, "They all have to look like me."
Yeah. There you go.
Literary Treks.
Ongoing 25, the Kittimer conflict begins.
And then you get to this starbase where Kirk and his crew are about to embark on their 5-year mission.
They're eventually going to go on this mission.
Right? Yeah.
Eventually.
It'll happen.
One of these days they're going to go.
It does kind of make me wonder if they're stalling because
they're stalling, yes.
Yeah, they're stalling because of the film.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So go and check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new shows for you every day of the week, and there are some days where we even have two shows for you. There are lots of ways for you to get them. iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox Zune. You can stream and download from the website. Go listen to us talk about DS9, Next Generation, every corner of the Star Trek universe. And you can hop over to trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all of those links. So, Matthew, I have a feeling, and I know our listeners, they do love to share their thoughts about the books with us. And if you'd like to do that, there are several ways you can. You can hop over to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. If you want to send Matthew and me an email that way, use that form. That'll come to both of us. You can go to the forums at trek.fm/forums and talk to other listeners and us about this novel and all the other stuff that's going on with the fall, other books. That's, again, at trek.fm/forums. You can send us a voicemail using the tab on the right-hand side of any page. Just click that, and you can use your webcam microphone to record a message and upload it to us. And then in social media, you know, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and we're always on Twitter under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, when you're not running around in the garden on the new DS9, frolicking in the green trees, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, they can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also look me up. I've got my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com, writing about all sorts of different things, movie reviews and all that kind of stuff. You can also check me out doing the Orb with you every week, where we talk Deep Space Nine all the time. So if you enjoyed the conversations that we're getting to have here with David, then you might enjoy when we do things on that show, because we just do Deep Space Nine and we love it. And if you don't love it, or you feel like you do love it and you just need another show to talk about that, then you're going to want to check us out there. That's for sure.
Yeah. Matthew's mission is to convert everyone into a Niner.
It's true. So. I'm not going to lie about it. So yeah, hopefully you'll like the show, though.
Great. Well, yeah, so you can find me, of course, with Matthew on The Orb. You can also find me on a similar show called Warp 5 every Friday with Kate Walsh, where we talk exclusively about Star Trek Enterprise. And then on the Ready Room, you'll find me and Matthew and people from all across the network. It's kind of our gathering. It's our core, as David originally put in the middle of the station here on the new DS9. Our core is the Ready Room, and you'll find us all over there where we talk about all the live-action Star Trek series every Wednesday. Now we've moved the show from Tuesday to Wednesday. And then in social media, you'll find me under the username C. Brian Jones. That's on Twitter and pretty much everywhere else. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And I also have my own personal website at cbrianjones.com. And Matthew, one more thing before we let everyone go. We'd like to ask you once again to please support our sponsor for this week's show, and that is Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website portfolio, online store, really anything that you can imagine. Go create your own space today. I promise you're going to love it. You can try it free for 14 days, no credit card required. And then when you sign up as a Trek FM listener, be sure to use offer code TREK10 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase and choose that annual plan to get the free custom domain registration. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Literary Treks and the network. Also, there's another way you can help us out. You can go to trek.fm/donate and get some aliens. We have 8 original alien illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. And they're available as badges or art prints, and you can mix and match what you like. And there are different contribution levels to choose from as well. So go pick what's right for you. Tell us which aliens you'd like to have, and we'll get those right over to you. And your donations help us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring Literary Treks to you every week. So we really appreciate your support.
And thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number